You're listening to Two Guys, One Album with music insiders Michael Heidemann and Paul Farva.
We are two music experts.
I mean, experts is pushing it.
Taking on the greatest albums of all time.
It's a little subjective.
Song by song with careful analysis.
All right, I wouldn't say careful. Look, we're having fun with the songs.
Two Guys,
One Album.
So excited for this next album. This is a great, great day for music.
We've had a lot of people asking about when we're going to do this.
Welcome to the real. That's right. It's Room for Squares. It's the debut studio album by American recording artist John Mayer, first released in June of 2001 by Aware Records. And Paul, do we have someone that is just one of the first guests, and I think one of the greatest guests we've had on the podcast yet?
If we're going to do a big artist, we need to have a big guest. And I know a lot of people wanted to come on to talk about John Mayer, but we figured we would get the guy who signed John Mayer to do the episode of Room for Squares on Two Guys, One Album, Greg Latterman.
Thank you.
Greg Latterman from Aware Records. John Mayer, Room for Squares. What do you got about this song?
Well, how much time do you guys have?
We are a show that only goes 30 minutes. We never, ever, ever go over 30.
All right, I'll keep it brief then.
That's a joke.
So,
yeah, we often go over 30s.
Yeah, so this record has a lot of Chicago roots because, one, you know, Aware was based here. And so Chicago has a lot of bass to it. And so the quick story, do you guys want to hear the story of how I signed him first?
Sure.
Well, let's hold on to that for real quick.
Maybe
let's see who the man we're talking to. I mean, we can't let your reputation not precede you. You're not only the owner, founder of Aware Records, you also are an entrepreneur. You are an academic, an angel investor. You do it all, and you do it all still here in Chicago, huh?
Yep.
That's incredible. And when you were getting started, this was one of your first, was it, can we say it's like one of your first like finds almost?
Train was the first.
Okay.
Five for Fighting was the second.
Oh,
Mayer was the third.
I love hearing you say those words.
Back in the day, in 2001, Aware Records was the place to be. Everybody that was anybody in the music industry, we always call ourselves music insiders on the show, jokingly, but legitimately, Aware Records was where that term started, in my opinion. Because I remember 2001, I was in a flailing band, and I was starting to manage bands, and everybody wanted to be there. And I remember John Mayer, when this album came out, and this song came on, everyone was like, wow. This is going to change music. And it did.
Yeah, it truly did. And we're going to dive right into it with Greg. Our rating system, as you all know, is out of the best out of 11 likes. Correct,
Paul? That's right, because that's when you can no longer see the names on social media. And it's when you finally made it on social media, when people like you 11 times. That's pretty much how it works.
Okay, so we go song by song with careful analysis, and then we give our rating at the end. Does that make sense, Greg?
I'm in.
Okay, let's.
And 11 is my lucky number, so.
So it all worked out. And the first song on this was No Such Thing, which I believe was the first release on this album. Is that right, Greg?
It was. It was the first single, yep.
And why did you guys choose this one?
Because when you're putting out a new artist, you want something with a little bit of tempo. Mm-hmm. Wonderland was what we thought was going to be the big song, which we recorded about 25 times before we got it right.
Wow.
And I'm not joking. It was we re-recorded that song over and over again. We never could get actually enough tempo on it. But he had played live enough times, including his first show in Chicago opening for Glenn Phillips at Shuba's. And when he'd play Wonderland, people would freak out. You didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
Like, you could just see people's faces. So we're like, that's the song, but we got to get there. So we felt the best way to get there was to go with the song that had more tempo and more upbeat. Honestly, No Such Thing outperformed way farther than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
And what was a catalyst to the song, I guess, coming to your attention and making it the first release?
Well, how did I sign John then?
Well, I mean, if that's where we're going to get to, yeah, let's
so,
do it.
So he had put out a record, an EP on his own,
right,
called Inside Wants Out. And a couple of these songs are on there, like Why Georgia, Neon was on there.
Yeah.
And I got that from his lawyer and heard it. My office at the time was at Adams in Ashland, which I wish I would have bought that building because it would have sold for about $10 million now.
Is that where Cobra Lounge is now?
Yeah, it's like Adams, but it's right. It's literally Adams before Ashland.
Okay, gotcha.
You got to look forward. You can't look back.
Yeah, it's all good. But but I heard it when our office was there through John's lawyer, and if you've ever heard Inside Once Out, you don't hear his guitar playing. So I didn't know he could play guitar like that. So I called his lawyer and said, I love this guy's voice. I love his lyrics. I love his melodies. Can I fly him in? That's how I used to sign bands. I didn't care how good you were live. I cared about seeing you in front of me and did I like you.
You would have them play for you, right?
Yeah, have them play for me. Yeah. And I was like, you know what? If you hustle, if you want this really bad and you're willing to hustle and you're that good, we'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of my thing. So he literally flew into Chicago, came to our loft in the West Loop. I had pizza, and I invited like 25 people over.
Deep dish or just thin crust?
Just thin crust.
Okay. Like
deep dish. And John played for 22. Literally, he walked in the door, and I'm like, get to work. You're going to play in front of a bunch of people. He's like, okay. And within like half of the first song, I was like, my jaw was on the ground because I didn't know he could play guitar like that.
Right.
So once he finished, he's like, what did you think? And I'm like, dude, we're done. Like, we're going to. If you want to sign with me, we're going to kill this. I know exactly what to do. You're the right guy at the right time. We've built up this amazing, you know, rep system. Like people, everything that we've done has been done for you. Mm-hmm. I didn't know you existed.
So wow. When he played for you, though, was he with just him and his acoustic guitar, or did he bring his electric?
Oh, no. Just him with acoustic. He was like sitting on a, you know, folding chair in my office.
Because, you know, his guitar skills don't really show up. I mean, unless you see him live and you see that he can jam on an electric guitar.
Yeah, but you see on acoustic though. It was
right.
It was ridiculous.
Okay.
So. Yeah. And then he literally stayed with me all weekend in my house in Evanston, and we kind of argued and talked and kind of came to a conclusion of you can be an artist, but you got to meet my commerce. And if you listen enough, you'll be the biggest artist in the world. And he had not gotten signed by other people because he didn't listen to anyone else. And I said, you can do whatever you want, but you got to listen enough to play the game, and I'll help you do that. And he's like, by the end of the weekend, he trusted me and he saw my track record. And he's like, I know, all I want to do is play songs, play my guitar, and have people come show up.
Wow. Let's dive into the next song. Song number two, you mentioned this before, it's Why Georgia.
This was on Inside, right? Mm-hmm.
So you were talking about how he lived with you for a little bit. What was his demeanor like? Why wasn't he listening to these other artists, and what made him listen to you?
Well, he just stayed with me for the weekend, but he was in his own world. He grew up without a big social base of friends and people. He literally, as he told me when I met him, he's like, I worked at a mobile station so I could buy an electric guitar and something else I'm not going to say in the air. And he would go in his room and practice guitar all day. And he's like, I didn't go to prom because I sat in my room playing the set I would have played at prom. So when you hear No Such Thing, No Such Thing is his song about going back to his high school, can we swear?
Yeah.
And saying, fuck you.
Right.
That's what No Such Thing was.
Yeah, he said, I can't wait till my 10-year reunion.
And by the way, he wasn't famous yet.
Right.
He literally, you know, our record deal was paying off his credit card debt and buying him a van and enough money for the first record. Mm-hmm. That was his deal.
It's incredible. And I remember growing up and listening to that song for the first time. I was in high school, and everyone just connected to that song right from the get-go, because there's nothing more lyrical that just cuts right to the core than you want to bust through the double doors, because everyone wants to go back to that 10-year reunion and just say, hey, look what I've done here. And you mentioned the fact that not many people know his guitar playing. Holy smokes, if you're a 16-year-old kid and you were trying to play No Such Thing, that's a tough song to play.
Yeah.
A lot of tough chords. You got to stretch those fingers.
And by the way, if you listen to the first record, he doesn't solo on it.
Yeah.
Oh.
And he and I, like, I tried to push him, and he's like, no, I'm not doing that. He's like, I want people to come to my shows,
and then,
see me, just like you did, and then go, oh. And I'm like, that was genius. Because he was right. Like, because it ended up being like his secret sauce, like his extra unfair advantage that he had over everybody else.
Yeah, because he has a singer, he has a songwriting ability, and you, like you said, when you first heard him, you didn't know he could play guitar, and you don't see that until you see, like, see it live. And I was fortunate enough to see him when he was rising every time he'd come, because a good friend of mine went to Berklee School of Music with him, so he'd always be like, hey, yeah, let's go hang out with John. And it was so fun. You'd be like, wow, this guy's the real deal.
He opens up on the records after that, but the first one and part of Heavier Things, like, you don't hear it.
So what about Why Georgia? This was already recorded.
Yeah.
And then what happened when you put it on Room for Squares?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was totally re-recorded, and John was actually excited to re-record the songs that he did on the EP, because he did those really simple, like, I think it was with him and a buddy, recorded them. So he was excited to, like, literally have those songs come to life the way he heard them and, like, stretch them a bit.
Mm-hmm. And that a lot to do with John Alasia too, right?
Yeah, and Alasia took them and really expanded them. And I mean, I think Why Georgia ended up being the third single.
Mm-hmm.
And it's absolutely a crowd favorite, especially
it's a great song.
In parts of the South. Anyone that knows Atlanta at all, people, like, sing every word to it. It's one of those easy songs to understand the lyrics.
Yeah, it gets you right from the song title. Now, I've never been able to ask this to anybody, because we haven't had any people who actually were there for an album's inception, but how important is the song structure on an album? Like, it's not so much important these days, because you're getting the singles and everything, but back when you were selling the full album, did you take time to be like, we need to put No Such Thing, the single, on top, and then go into it with... Okay.
I'd say where I add the most value, if I add value, you'd have to ask John or any of my artists, is... I obsess over the sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad not enough people do that anymore, you know?
I could probably tell you, if I really think back, like, why... And once again, John had absolute control over the sequence, but I probably made several sequences, at least for the first record. After that, he took full control, but the first record, I'm like, let's go with the first song, because back in the day, if you're, you know, at Tower Records and you're on a...
Those listening booths.
Yeah, or whatever.
That's right.
You want them to listen to the first song.
Mm-hmm.
So our whole thing was, if we only get one song, we want them to play the single.
Mm-hmm. That's a genius.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about
it. You couldn't put Your Body's a Wonderland to start off because of the tempo, right?
Yeah, and we wanted people to get to know John first and, like, kind of. And by the way, John was also careful. He didn't want people to know him only as a ballad as well. So it was important to put a little tempo in front of that.
Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a driving force. It's you're taking the listener on a ride almost with this album.
We want to have, like, an arc,
mm-hmm.
just like it's a film. You mm-hmm. can't just have a straight line. So you got to go up and down and up and down. But there's got to be, like, and when we get to the end,
we'll talk about that.
It feels like a movie for
sure. Let's dive into song number three, My Stupid Mouth.
Now, this was on Inside, right?
Yeah, and if I remember right, this was the song that caught me. Like, this was the first song that I heard when I was listening to the EP going, oh, I love this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I think this was the one that pulled me in, if I remember right.
And he wrote all these songs by himself, too, structurally, or what? Was there more Inside?
I mean, pretty much he wrote by himself, and I don't know, but I think Clay Cook, there's a couple people that wrote some of the early songs. He actually was an acoustic duo coming out of Berklee. I think mm-hmm. it was with Clay.
Right.
So some of those early songs were written together. And John co-writes with people, but for the most part.
And you know, a lot of people, you know, shit on artists that do really well, you know, and stuff like Maroon 5 I'd put in this category too. But, like, when you don't listen to this album, like, I have not heard My Stupid Mouth in at least 10 years. It still holds up. Like, just listening to it right now, I'm like, I was waiting, because we always have one song that we don't like on the album, and we have a pass that we can do.
Yeah, we have the power to skip on this podcast.
Yeah, but I thought that was going to be the one, but it's not.
And we recorded, and I actually was looking for it. I couldn't find it, and I have it somewhere, but... because I videotaped a lot of making this record, and mm-hmm. we made it at John Alasia's parents' cottage in somewhere in Maryland on the Chesapeake. But it wasn't fancy. And John would literally wake up, and I have him, videos of him, like, playing guitar and singing in his boxer shorts and t-shirt. And it was literally him. The engineer is John Giuliano, who's now a massive mixer in the country world.
Mm-hmm.
He engineered it. John was a producer, and it was just the three of them and we'd fly people. We'd fly the bass guy. You know, we'd fly people in and out. I think we did drums somewhere else, but we did all the basics at his parents' house to save money.
Yeah, it looks like you have a little bit of production here. You mentioned Jeff or John Giuliano, Jack Joseph Puig, Scott Hull did some mastering. John Mark Painter, Dan Fallon, Alex Fallon, and Joshua.
Well, that's when we get to the remix.
Oh,
so the initial record that we made with 12 songs.
Mm-hmm.
Was all John Alasia.
Wow.
So we'll talk about the evolution.
Difference. Okay. Well, we'll get to the next song, which is probably one of the most popular songs of that decade, at least one of them.
Your body is a wonderland. Now, did you hear, was there folklore that this song was about Jennifer Love Hewitt? Am I just making that up, or was that just...
Well, I don't want to get into too much of John's personal life. It was only about the fantasy of her.
Okay.
But
okay.
He did date her after it became a hit.
You know, once if you put it out there, sometimes positivity kind of flows you in that direction. Good for him.
So, yeah. So maybe it was his thinking. I never heard that personally, but he did date her after because it was a hit.
I did hear that. I did hear that it was about her. But
before or after you, Paul?
No. I've only seen her once at a Dodgers game.
Well, she's now on Chicago Fire or PD. She's on one of the Chicago shows now.
Really?
Yeah, so
she's
Chicago
actually living here now.
Med, so I probably run into her on the set. But yeah, I mean, this song, people make fun of John Mayer for this song, but it still holds up.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make, you know, I have a joke about my body being a wonderland when I was younger and now being homeland, but that was based on John Mayer, and this song was so good, and guys would probably not want to admit to liking it, but secretly every guy listened to it and wanted to learn how to play it on guitar.
I think like one of my favorite moments of people are just like you know, what did you really enjoy? And honestly, I think most of the time I was in the music business, I was just trying to break my bands, and I was just hustling so hard. But watching John at the Grammys do "Your Body's a Wonderland" when no one really knew who he was. And I was like in the fourth or fifth row with like the chairman of Sony. Like once again, I didn't have many of these glory moments, so I don't want to, you know, sound like a big ego guy, but like all the hip hop dudes were in front of us. And John comes out like, he's like by himself with an acoustic guitar, standing like 5 feet from the front of the stage after everyone had these massive, and it was just him with an acoustic. And everyone's like, who's this white guy? What's he going to do? And he started playing guitar, and like by the end of the song, all the hip hop people in the front row were going crazy. And that was like John's
awesome.
Like coming out party to me. It was like, it's now like, now it's spreading outside our little pop rock world. And he just owned that song. And even though it's a ballad, it was so powerful the way he played it and just had that emotion coming out of him. That it ended up being, I thought like that was his moment where he kind of, that was like the launching point. To
that's
the next
where
level.
Jennifer Love Hewitt probably saw him too.
Sure.
Well, also the fact that, like you said, it's pop and it transcends, you know, people in other genres. You can't deny a song that's a hit,
yeah,
or with something with a hook like this.
Something that's the best thing about music. No matter who you are, where you're coming from, if you hear that song and it just touches you in the right way, or just tickles you in that special place, it's.
I don't know what you're saying.
It makes that difference. You can feel music. It's something that we all are connected by. And it's just sounds that are just coming from an instrument, like a wood instrument. It's truly great. And you're right, he did, he accepted that Grammy for this song, Best Male Pop Vocal Performance, in 2003. So obviously there was something behind this. It's one of the greatest songs, especially one of the greatest ballads in the last, 20 years?
You can't shit on it.
Mm-mm. So you're saying you're not going to skip this song, Paul?
No, I can't. Okay. I still like it. I mean, we already listened to it, and people are probably pissed that we're talking over it.
Oh,
it's like, oh yeah, I haven't heard this in a while. Well, we gotta go to the next song.
All right, let's go into it.
This is Neon, number 5.
Another song that was on the EP.
Yep.
Another. I mean, it was actually, you know, another song that everyone loves. It's a little. If there is a cheesier song on purpose, it's cheesy. It's called Neon. So that's like John Mayer. He just takes it head on. But good tempo. You know.
I didn't like this song when it came out. I'm going to tell you that right now, Greg. But I still don't like it.
All right.
But is there a story behind why you told him to keep it? This is the one that was on the, like you said, on the EP.
Because live people loved it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a slap, it's also like a bass slap song. So it's one of those songs live funkier. In the early days. You have to remember, John toured just by himself. And then he never took tour support. So we bought him a van. And he'd sell so many CDs at shows. If he played for 150 people at Shubas, he'd sell 300 CDs.
Right.
Like, no one's ever multiplied, right? Like, you guys know artists, right? Like,
yeah.
If you sold, like, 20% back in the day, you'd be like, yes. He would, like, double. Because people would buy two and three.
Yeah.
Every time.
And shirts and everything. I remember seeing him at House of Blues just
he'd sell out.
Getting slammed.
He would sit back there and sell his own merch, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just connect with the fans that way. I love that.
His first tour was opening for Glenn. So when we were making this record, we wanted to get his tour base going. He had stuff going in Birmingham and in Atlanta, because he was living in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever we could, he'd fly out and play dates opening for Glenn Phillips, who we managed. And when originally we thought it was going to be like a tour support thing, he would literally sell so many CDs, he would just pay for his ticket and put money in his pocket. So he never took any money. And then he bought a van for, you know, the first tour. And it was just him with a tour manager and then him with a bass player, David Labriere.
Mm-hmm.
And then once he made, but he would always, he was like, it was really, he really wanted to do it himself and always make enough money. Then we added a drummer. It was a three piece.
Right.
And so if you saw John in the early days, it was literally every time you saw him, they added something.
Well, the first time I remember seeing him was at Shubas by himself.
Yeah.
And then he came back and did the House of Blues shows with the duo, with the bass.
Yep.
But it was funny because it was a sold out show.
Yeah.
And House of Blues is a huge room and there's no percussion, really. I mean, the bass. But he had everyone in their hands within the first song. It was pretty insane. And then, like you said, he'd go out afterwards and sell merch. And I mean, there'd be lines of people just waiting.
Yep.
You don't see that for anyone.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Not today. I mean, there's not that similar connection, because a lot of the artists today, they're, and I know we talked about this so much that it's almost cliche, but a lot of people are from YouTube and and they go up there and they think that they're the greatest band and they have security when they don't even have a real fan base outside of the digital realm. So to see him connecting with these fans, especially way back when, he seems like the real deal. I'm actually, the more I'm listening to this album and hearing these stories, I'm liking John Mayer more and more and more.
Well, I mean, it was fun. I talk about when we hang out with him after shows, and I have a joke kind of about it as well, a story about him. I expected like this. I was like back then, and Greg, I met you, like you don't remember, but I met you back in 2003 when I was managing bands and playing in bands. So for those of you who don't believe that, it was a true story. You made Dan Dara come and play
up
and
Dan,
your shag carpeting all over your office. But what I was excited about back then was I was just getting into the music industry, and I was like, okay, I'm going to go to my first after party with John Mayer. There's going to be hookers and blow, and it's going to be all this crazy shit. Mm-hmm. And he was just like this laid back guy. I was the only person drinking in this whole party of his crew, which was pretty small back when he was doing House of Blues.
He didn't drink then at all.
He didn't drink at all.
He started drinking wine after that. And now
they were playing video games. They were playing video games. I'm like, this is the worst rock star experience I've ever had in my life.
That was all my bands.
Did you?
He was down to earth. He was super cool and everything.
Did you make a point to have them not drink and kind of focus on their craft rather than get involved in the typical rock and roll classic stuff of drinking and drugs? And
I just didn't want to put up with that. And maybe I was lucky enough to, like, I mean, my whole thing was I only wanted to work with bands that I would want to be a part of my family and be a part of our family. So every band we signed slept at my house before I signed them, like John did, like all of them did.
Wow.
And to me, it was, like I said, I do it now with entrepreneurs. It's like, it's about you have to have talent, but you have to have hustle.
Mm-hmm.
You have to want it, and you have to be a good person, because there is a game to play. It doesn't matter how good you are, what you've done. Like, you have to get along with people enough. And so my whole test was like, hey, do I like you? Do you like me? And if not, let's not do this. And so we also built a really big management company, and we managed a lot of big bands, but like there were many meetings I'd go in for management, and halfway through I'd be like, who are you talking to? And they'd tell me, I'm like, you should just go with them. And like, no one's ever said that to us before. I'm like, well, I'm not going to do this. Like, I don't feel a connection with you. So and I didn't sign a lot of bands. So the bands that we signed, and I was talking to someone about this the other day, like the album cycles that didn't go well, I'm as proud of as this one, because we eked out a 2.5 years or 3 years of touring momentum when no one else cared.
Mm-hmm.
that's real work. It's not hard when it works. Mm-hmm. Like, that's fun.
Yeah.
But we have artists that are doing that have successful careers because we grinded through it.
Wow.
Let's dive into the next song real quick. City Love.
You gotta love what you're doing. You gotta love the city.
Oh, did I step all over your intro to that? Sorry, Paul.
Now, this was not on the original. What's the story on this song?
So, this was, I could be wrong. I think it was the second to last song written for this album. And we had a meeting, and there's a documentary that you can get online that is like John Alasia, his manager, Michael McDonald at the time, myself. Like, we're sitting in John Alasia's apartment going through the song, what's going to make the record. And City Love was like a last second one. And it was so new. John ended up using John Alasia's girlfriend's name at the time, Lydia, to finish the song. So Lydia, if you listen to the song, he says, Lydia, that's the girl in the thing. It just happened to be Alasia's girlfriend. And so when he heard that, he's like, oh, that's the name I'll use. And it ended up like finishing the song.
It sounds like something that would be in a soundtrack. Did it ever get picked up in a soundtrack?
I don't know if we did or not on this one. But by the way, you're talking about like the tempo, like Neon was like a big up thing, and then it kind of like comes down a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And that was track picking that you did? You were involved in it?
You know what? Once again, I'm not going to take credit for anything John Mayer does, but I have to assume that between Lee Dene, who A&R'd the record with me, like, I'm sure we were, like I said, we were making cassettes and handing back and forth, so hopefully we had some help with this, but John had such a vision for this album, I wouldn't take that away.
Yeah.
Or take any credit.
You were talking about if you had any bands that kind of slipped away, like there were some bands you didn't want to work with. Do you have any bands you're looking back and you said, dang, I wish I would have worked with Aerosmith or Chumbawamba at the time, because that would have been great for the label?
No, because like if you go back, I started by doing compilations of unsigned bands.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to be a part of so many bands, like lives and careers, without having to like manage them or sign them.
Mm-hmm.
So like Mooney the Blowfish to like Jack Johnson. Jack Johnson's the one that like I would have loved to sign, because I think he's just the greatest guy in the world and mm-hmm. coolest guy, but I couldn't bring him to Columbia Records because of what he didn't want to make videos and stuff, and he ended up signing at Republic with Monty and Avery Lippman, who are the perfect people for his career. So I wish I could have been a part of Jack's career, but it wouldn't have worked where I was.
Yeah. Oh, is that why when he makes music videos, they're always just him sitting in
surfing
some
guy,
surfing, sitting
well,
on a rock somewhere.
Originally, he wasn't going to make any, but...
Huh.
But
well, I mean, those compilation CDs were amazing. I mean, there's so many artists that you
like
got,
Matchbox 20.
You guys broke on there,
So it was a way for me to be involved without having to live it. Because like I said, the artists that we signed, I wanted to go. I mean, we didn't sign many bands. We just didn't.
And I remember back in the day, Blue was an artist you guys work with. And I, to this day, still listen to Blue. I mean, that album, Blutopia, was it Blutopia?
I think it was Blutopia. He's in L.A. making a living as a songwriter.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the next number 783. Let's hear a little bit about this. I don't even remember what this song goes.
You know what it's about?
1987.
It's about the year John Mayer was born.
Oh, man. That makes sense.
Behind the album.
All right.
Let's talk about the album for a little bit. So, did you when you're helping the artist put together the panel and the disc itself? First of all, who is this photo of? Is this John?
That's John. Yeah.
Cartoon photo of John Mayer on the back
Child.
Of the disc cassette.
And that was like one of his biggest T-shirts to this day. Is that? Yeah.
I can remember that image now. Now, did you help him with this? Were you like, John, you know, maybe you shouldn't put a picture of your baby self in the...
No, we thought it was pretty cool. But, like, I mean, the original Aware stuff is super simple.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Natkin, famous
Chicago photographer
who we absolutely love and support, did all the art, did all the photos.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you to this day, I think John still invites him to every show. Like, he's been very, very supportive of Paul.
Paul's a great supporter of music in Chicago.
He's the best. So literally this original artwork, I think we had like a $5,000 budget or something. So we did, we had Paul do the photo shoot. I guarantee you the photos that, if you can see the original Aware cover, mm-hmm. those were probably taken at the Shubas photo booth.
Nice.
You don't say.
I bet you.
Yeah, right here. I got it on the original copy.
I'm going to bet you that. It was a super simple artwork because what we decided to do was to put this out mail order and in indie stores over the summer while we set up the big major label push.
Jeez.
Yeah.
A lot of work goes into creating this album. How much time do you think you can estimate that went into just putting out this album? Were you feeling like this is one of those artists that you should put a little extra work into?
No, dude. I did with every artist.
Yeah.
I didn't sign that many artists. And so what happened was Train's first album we put out independently. Mm-hmm. Worked it for a year and a half. Second single, Meet Virginia, took off. 2 years in, we moved it to Columbia. So that first Train record took 4 years. While we were doing that, everyone got excited about Five for Fighting and said, let's just put it out on Columbia. We got this. Did 400 the first week. Died. We grinded it for 2 years. Superman, second single, became a hit. Ended up selling 2 million albums. Same with Train's first record. So we got to John Mayer. I'm like, I don't trust anybody. Sorry, Columbia. I love you. Don't trust you. Same thing with John and John's management. And John's team was like, once again, sounds cocky. It was like the super team, like agent, manager, lawyer. All of us were really good friends, but we'd never worked on one thing and the product manager, all from the start.
Mm-hmm.
So this was like the most exciting thing. So we fought and talked about every detail of anything.
That's so cool.
And John was absolutely in charge, but he knew he had this team of people, publicists, everybody like had his best interest and nothing would be done without his say. But all of us would like fight, like everyone had been involved with other things that were similar,
mm-hmm.
and everyone had this feeling of like, this is the one. So jeez. How much time we put into it? Didn't matter. Like we just lived it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's incredible. It's incredible to hear these stories because right now you look back at John Mayer and you see him today and you're like, oh, he must have had this from the start. You never think about all the immense amount of work and all the people that go into creating such an amazing artist. You know, it's you often forget about the people who are actually putting in the blood, sweat, and tears to make somebody great. I mean, to light that candle of a talent is only so much. You need that right kind of team behind you and Greg, it sounds like you just blessed them off in outer space.
Yeah, you guys had a great team. Reed Hunter was a lawyer, and I remember him, and Mike McDonald, who's still doing great things.
Scott Clayton, the agent's now one of the biggest agents in the world.
Yeah, it's so funny. They all kind of got basically this made it happen. Next song, number 8, Love Song for No One, which is my favorite song on this album.
All right, so I have 3x5. Now, this am I?
You're remix? Looking at the Columbia one.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
How 3x5 did not exist on the original record.
Hold on, let me burn this album real quick.
Oh, so this is three. That's the deluxe copy. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Cool. Love Songs for No One. We're just, you know, I picked the song to skip. 3x5. Who
okay.
needs it?
Brings us to our next song, which is my favorite song on the album, Love Song for No One.
Love Songs for No One.
Love Song. Now you're saying, Greg, this is a song. Can you hear it now?
Yeah.
Staying home alone on a Friday, flat on the floor looking back on
I just feel like this is a perfect song. It's like a nod to the 80s in a way.
Just really personal for you.
Yeah, no.
Sitting alone on a Friday.
Perhaps. Maybe that's why I liked it so much, but I always thought it was going to be a hit song, and it never was.
Yeah, I don't want to get the nuances of how you break a song or bore the audience, but it would have been hard.
Is it because of the tempo being similar to...
Well, we had to go to AAA first.
Yeah.
His audience was top 40, but you can't start there.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to find a bridge to get to top 40, which took a long time.
And this was also not on... Or wait, was this on the EP?
I don't think so.
No. He's got an acoustic version of it somewhere.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, this is the best song on the album, in my opinion.
This was your favorite?
Yeah, yeah.
You played on repeat?
All day, all night, on a Friday night.
I like it. You know, it's interesting because I'm rediscovering this album, like going through it like I do most of our albums on the podcast, and I don't know. Sometimes I feel like some songs would work in different decades or different years, like depending on what's going on in the world. I feel like this song would work today.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as bad as that U2 album that we talked about a few years ago.
I have not heard this song. Again, this is one of those things where I haven't heard this song in over 10 years and it still holds up. So.
You want to dive into Back to You?
Back to You, yeah.
Aw. Paul, that was so sweet of you.
Here we are. So what's the story on this song, Greg?
I'm pretty sure this was on Inside Once Out. But it's another just like really comfortable, like to me this is like, it's a nice foggy day, put your nice sweater on and read a book and have a glass of wine. It's like, you know.
You know, there's something about the vibe you created with this album. All the songs are so clean and crisp. It's just great musicianship built with great lyrics. Did you have like a mission statement when you were creating this album, Room for Squares? Like, was there an idea?
I'm just laughing because now I teach entrepreneurship at Northwestern, and you know, I don't think I had any mission statements when I was making albums with artists. Mm-hmm. No, I think the whole goal was, you know, John had spent his whole life thinking about this first album, mm-hmm. like being released and hopefully the world hearing it. So we just wanted to, honestly, everyone involved on his team was like, we just want to do everything we can to make sure this gets out the way you want. Mm-hmm. And the whole plan was pretty simple. It was like, we're going to buy you a van. There's no time limit. So as long as we get a new fan every single day, every time you play a show, mm-hmm. we're going to win. And we're not going to worry about radio right now. We just want to gain fans. And this, you know, MySpace was around. So we got a little lucky with the digital social media. So we were able to get his following happening fast. Mm-hmm. But still, it was like, as I say to people, like, if you look at like where it crossed between digital and analog, like, we were gaining fans faster than we would have because of digital, but we were still selling albums. Mm-hmm. So it was like we had analog going with digital, and John Mayer was at peak. Like 02, 03 was like that perfect, like, talk about like when I managed the fray. The analog started going down by then, mm-hmm. in 06, 07.
It was the perfect time. Yeah, being in the smallest suburb in Illinois, or even the deepest, farthest town, you knew this guy's name. I mean, the way that you guys crafted this marketing campaign around him, he didn't need it because he had the talent, yes, but no one was going around and who didn't know John Mayer at the time. He was like, every girl loved him, every guy wanted to be him at that time, which is something to say.
Like I said, honestly, when I first saw him play, I'm like, this company that we've created and all the people, we had 5,000 college reps. We're like, everyone is going to get who you are and what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And honestly, our whole goal is just to support you, mm-hmm. and not let timing matter. So if it takes a little longer, who cares?
Yeah.
But you guys had you had this college rep program, which sadly wouldn't work today, because working with bands, you know, you guys everyone bought into this Aware Records, which is a great concept of getting everybody to help out. Hey, go put up some posters, go do this, go do that. And it all worked because everyone's on the same team. Now it's so hard with everybody with digital, in a way, like you said, everyone's like, oh, I'll just post about it, or I'll put it on Facebook. No one's like doing the grunt work that's required.
It worked really well because we'd sell them CDs for $5 and they'd sell them for $10 and $15.
Right.
So that's why it really worked. Like, they love the music, but they're also
making
their beer money off of actually being excited.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
Is there one artist out there specifically that you think is doing the just the whole plan correctly?
Today?
Yeah, today.
That's why I'm not in the music business.
He's out. He checked out. Probably Kanye West, is my opinion, is doing it right. That was me talking, not Greg.
Yeah, I'm not.
Don't want to get backlash. This is great outdoors.
Great.
Like, I think this is like just
indoors.
This is just a fun song, mm-hmm. you know. That's why it's on the back of the record. It's like, hey, this record's been great. I need to chill out for a minute, you know.
Yeah, you could put this whole album in pretty much, except for Neon, and it'll be great. It's a great album. This was not on the EP, right? This is something you wrote after?
No, this was new.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember in the studio with John Mayer, was there anything specific that he needed? Was he more of like a hoagie sandwich kind of guy and soda pop, or was he, what did he need to create?
We are in Easton, Maryland. I just remembered it. Mm-hmm. And the only restaurant was like an Applebee's. So I actually think our budget for their food, they probably went and got like bologna. And I get like, John Alasia is the greatest guy in the world, and he's so focused. Mm-hmm. I was just with him a couple weeks ago, and they probably went and bought, like, I'm not joking, some cereal, some cold cuts, and they didn't even worry about food. They just had enough, because they were like working 20 hours a day.
Wow, focused, yeah.
Is there a good, I mean, while we have you in the hot seat, I guess I could ask these questions that I've always wanted to ask. Is there a certain time of day that works best for some of these artists? Morning, night, or does it just depend
usually
on the
night,
creativity?
Almost everyone, like, their voice. But by the way, most good studios, which this wasn't, doesn't matter, because, like, you could be at some of the studios in New York and L.A., and it feels like it's 2 in the morning
so dark,
the whole
yeah.
time.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, most of the time people do their best at night, like, because they're just, their vocals are warmed up, and mm-hmm. like they're just more alert. So most people sing vocals later in the night.
Okay.
So they can be themselves. Speaking of which, the next song is Not Myself, number 11. I don't even remember this song.
Suppose I said
I have zero recollection of this song. Has this always been on the album?
It has.
Is this your favorite song, Greg?
Once again, when of the sequence of the record, I loved when this came on, because like to me, it's a movie, right? Like I've had a great time. This is awesome. Almost over,
nearing the end, yeah.
And you know what, keep me entertained a little bit more and I'm good. And so to me, once again, I thought it was the perfect second to last song.
Yeah,
it is kind of, it does have a feeling of the ending, yeah, coming through.
It's setting up, which I think is, honestly, I think the last song on this album is like the best last song on any album.
Let's play it.
Let's dive right into it.
Yeah, St. Patrick's Day.
I just for a second, can I just say, this is taking me back. I remember sitting at a bonfire with my friends, and this was like the perfect soundtrack for just hanging out with your buddies and just looking back and being like, wow, you know, high school is going by so fast, man.
17 years ago.
Yeah, that's insane.
So let me tell you, so basically we were sitting around in John Lee's apartment, and John goes, I think I wrote another one. And he picked up his guitar and he played this song.
Why is it called St. Patrick's Day?
He says it.
That's it?
Yeah, I don't know. But
no Lydia story?
Yeah, no, when he played this, we're like, that is how you end this record. Done.
Mm-hmm.
Like, put a bow around it. We're done.
Why was there only 12 songs? Why wasn't there 13?
Yeah, we must know.
No, that's on the next one. So.
Oh, the deluxe, you mean?
Yes.
Right.
Not the deluxe. So this was just, this was meant to be put out independently through us.
Mm-hmm.
To mitigate what happened with Five for Fighting.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to do the hybrid in between what we do with Train, because we worked the record for 2 years by ourselves, right? So we're like, let's we know what we have here, and we need to probably remix this and do better artwork. So instead of just wasting the next 3 or 4 months, I said, let me do this. I got it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a really good so Don Van Cleave and Scott Register in Birmingham, Alabama, we're coming to our Aware show in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
They started something called the Indie Coalition. So they connected all the indie stores in the country. It still mm-hmm. exists. So they're like, give us this record. Give us 15,000. I think we gave them 15,000, and I did 10,000 of mail order, and we sold them out in 2 months. And so we did 25,000 of these. I mean, John Hand signed probably 5,000. So people knew that. Like, we just made it super special. And then as we were working this over the summer and John was touring, we did the artwork from scratch for the Columbia Aware release. And we're like, how do we make this record so we can get a lot of the people that bought the original one want to buy the new one? Mm-hmm. How do we create enough value that they're going to buy this one and be excited that they had the original one and the new one? And so with that thought, the artwork was easy, right? We're going to do better artwork. But we think, and John started talking about, John's like, you know, I think we can make this bigger and better sounding. So so I was friends, I think I can take the credit for this, with Jack Joseph Puig, who I'd done a lot of stuff with. So I introduced John to Jack. Elijah probably knew him too, but in Lead and A with me. And we ended up having Jack take over the record and like mix the whole thing. He added a little production. And in the midst of that, John wrote a new song called 3x5. And as we were talking about what do we do, John's like, I kind of want to add another song. We're like, yeah, that plays into this whole value proposition of having more. And so when we did that, that would have made the 13th track. And I was really superstitious back then, and like everything had gone so well, and I freaked out. I'm like, no, we can't have 13 tracks. And we started talking about it, and I think John or someone was like, there's a lot of buildings that don't have 13 floors. So we're like, done. There's no 13th track. And then so there's no 13th track. And my favorite story of someone asking me this was the next Grammys, when John was up for Daughters. John, what was the host's name? Late night guy that's retired now. John.
Olive Stewart?
John Stewart. John Stewart's a massive Mayer fan. And so I was with a friend of his and a friend of mine, and he was the host that year of the Grammys. So we're backstage at the Grammys that year. He starts asking me about everything about this record. And John was with me. He's like, why is there no 13th track? And John goes, talk to him.
Points to you.
Points to me. And I told him, he goes, makes sense. I go, it worked. Now I'm not superstitious anymore, by the way, because of that. I'm good now.
Okay.
I still am. I don't, if someone has 12 likes on something on Instagram or Facebook, I won't be the 13th like. That's just the way it works. Which brings us to our rating system.
The rating
time
system.
Time to rate the album.
I'm very excited. This was, to be honest, I love the album now. I teared up a few times during the stories. it means a lot that you joined us here today, Greg, because we've never had somebody so engrossed into an album.
A real music insider.
Yes, you are our first real music insider in the show. We've had fans, but we're very excited. I'm so excited to hear Greg's rating, but I think, yeah, we should give ours first. Set the stage.
I'm going to give this
well,
album.
Well, let's go through it, what we do one more time. Yeah, so
you go up to 11. That's the highest you can rate is likes. Is 11 likes is the highest. Nobody's received that yet. But for me, I'm going to get this album was instrumental in me getting into the music industry. I remember everything about the album coming out. I was like, wow, this is exactly what I want to be doing. And I love the songs. I love the songwriting. And I was a guitarist. I thought he was an amazing guitarist. I'm going to give it 8 likes. I'm also going to include a red wine emoji because, like you said, sitting back listening to wine. Guitar emoji because he's an amazing guitarist people don't know. And also the joystick because my only memory of John Mayer is when I went backstage to my first rock and roll after party and all they were doing was playing video games. And it ruined my whole life.
See, I think it's a bunch of shit. How can you only give it 8?
8 is the... I'm very tough. I've never given anyone above 8.
Oh, he came close with the Counting Crows.
August and Everything.
What would you give it?
I gave that 9, but that album is one of my greatest.
Yeah, my favorite records too. So, but it's not.
Everyone has a different rating system, Greg. Go ahead. Michael, what are you getting at?
All right. A fantastic album. I've never, to be honest, hand to God, never heard it all the way through. I listened to it 100 times in my friends' cars, but never all the way through front to back, and had so much insight from it. You know what? I wish we could do this every single episode because it gives the album
backstory
a whole other dimension. But yeah, down to the rating. I really like this album. The more I thought about it, it was so
give
clean.
Give the rating, Michael. You're stalling.
It was so clean that I can't deny the musicianship. I gave it, didn't reach Blink 182 heights, but 9.5. Nine and a half likes.
Wow, nice. That's a high number likes. For you.
I gave it the Doors emoji for busting through the doors. Of course, the brown haired girl, Jennifer Love Hewitt, who we mentioned earlier. Always
the emoji, yeah.
I mean, and also any brown haired girl, because you listen to this song and you think about, man, this would be a great song to put on a date, right? I don't know, maybe just me. And of course, the fire from the bonfire memories that I had in high school.
The fire emoji. Greg, what are you giving this album?
Dude, this is easy. It's 11. Are you kidding me?
Yes.
11, I'll cross the board.
The first yeah. 11 we've had on the podcast.
I don't want to, but by the way, I truly love this album and every song on it. So like, I'm being genuine. I could also put on top of that, that, you know, materially, this record made my life. Like
sure.
All my, my house and we're like, yes, this
nice
is the John Mayer
wearing,
house.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is my, you know, John Mayer boat. So like, we do those things. And then like Pat from Train gets mad at me and says, what about me? I'm like, you, the pool. So, but no,
just
but like,
pool.
But no, actually, no joke. Like I really love every song on this album. So
Even Neon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yep. that's true love. It's like, it's his baby.
It is.
How could you not love your baby?
That's true.
I got to ask before we let you get out of here, and thank you again for your time. This was a total pleasure, man.
Yeah.
When you're sitting in front of your students at Northwestern or wherever, and you're speaking to them, does this never come up? The fact that you created John Mayer. What are they saying to you in the classroom? I could never look at you the same way ever again.
It depends, because I do sometimes pull rank and have artists come in. Like I've had Matt Carney come in surprise and play songs and. Isaac Slade from The Fray just texted me while I'm talking.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it just depends. Like I'll try to bring really cool people in and stuff. So, and they get it, but I'm also their professor. So it's kind of like, you know what I mean? Like
you're still not getting invited to the kegger.
Yeah. It's just a different world, but I hopefully they respect that, you know,
yeah.
But I don't know.
It's so cool, Greg. And also we want to definitely mention you have an amazing show coming out. Why don't you tell us more about this Aware reunion show?
Yeah, so we're doing a 25th anniversary Aware record show at House of Blues on November 10th. And it is Alice Peacock.
Wow.
Opening.
She's great.
Yeah, she's great from Chicago. We should play actually her single John Mayer sang on, and it should have been a smash. It was close to being a massive hit. And then it's Stir from St. Louis, who was my second band I ever signed, who went on my second year at Kellogg. I flipped that record to Capitol Records for a ton of money. It's my first big thing. Then it's Brian from the Verve Pipe, who's from my hometown,
York, yeah.
My hometown of East Lansing. The drummer used to be my, used to mow my lawn as a child.
They still have stories about him and posters of him at Royal Oak Theater, and, which I just performed at last week. So
Brian's a great guy. And then, Matt, the lead singer of Vertical Horizon, who's a really close friend, and he wanted to come in and do it. And then Carrie and Jack from Jekyll Pierce.
Nice.
And Isaac Slade is going to come do a couple songs from The Fray.
From The Fray, yeah.
And they're still trying to get a couple other people that are pretty big.
Surprises.
Yeah.
And where can people find out more about this and get tickets for it?
Probably easy. Just go to House of Blues.
HOB.com.
Yeah, an Aware show, and you can go. Google anything, Aware show, House of Blues, and it'll come up.
Awesome.
Incredible. Awesome. Incredible.
Well, that's our episode of Room for Squares, John Mayer. For all you guys that were asking when we're going to do John Mayer, we've done it now. We've done John Mayer, so please stop bothering us. You're not going to come on and talk about it.
That's right, and we've done it right. So if you want to reach out to us with any questions, comments, concerns that you have, you can reach us at twoguysonealbum@gmail.com. That's the number two. That's the number one. You can find us on Twitter there, too. Paul, where can they find you?
Paul F. Comedy is my site, or Paul F. Comedy on Instagram, Facebook, all that. Or no, Paul Farvar on Instagram, whatever.
Yep, and you can find me at michaelheideman.com. You can find me at Michael Heideman, Mike Heideman on Twitter. And you can listen to me every night here at WGN.
And Greg, where can people, you've tuned out. You've tuned out.
No,
on,
I was trying to see
social, it. No, I mean in social media.
Oh.
You're no longer connected in the world. You're still on your MySpace page?
Yeah, no, my Friendster page. No, so you can find me on Instagram.
You have an Instagram page? All right.
But I'd love you to go to Positive Pretzels.
Oh, yeah.
Instagram,
oh, yeah.
My new pretzel company that we're about to launch. We'll be in Whole Foods all of Chicago starting in December.
Awesome.
Or all of Whole Foods Midwest, actually. and then hopefully the rest of the country soon after. So Positive Pretzels, I probably prefer them to follow that way.
All right. And then, of course, go to the Aware concert at House of Blues. Get your tickets at HOB.com. And that's a wrap on Two Guys.
One Album. See you next week.